Hey, I'm Chase from Iowa.
I'm Alex from Chicago.
I'm Jake from Downers Grove.
Sound of Young America is produced independently
and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is one of the most accomplished comics authors of the last 25 years or so, Dan Klaus. He's the author of, among others, David Boring and Ghost World, and wrote for many years the comic 8-Ball. His newest work is his first ever graphic novel written specifically for that form. It's called Wilson. Dan Klaus, welcome back to the Sound of Young America.
Hello, sir.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So this came to me right with the pitch. This is Dan Klaus's first ever work that wasn't serialized anywhere else, wasn't written to be in, you know, comic book form before
right.
It was bound into a big hardback, et cetera, et cetera. So when I opened it, I was surprised to note that the form is essentially 50 or 60 sort of Sunday comics, one page, separate individual pieces.
Right. It's some kind of a regression, I guess.
How did you fall into that shape?
You know, it came very naturally. I mean, I had decided that I was done doing the serialized comics. You know, for years that was the format that we all looked to, was to do the comics of our youth, or in my case, the comics of my teenage years. I was trying to do like a underground comic, like Zap Comics, the kind of things Robert Crumb did. And, you know, for years that was my form of choice. And just in the last 5 to 10 years or so, the marketplace has changed so much that the idea of doing serialized comic books seems like this quaint, old-fashioned notion. It seems like an affectation at this point to do a comic book. You know, it seems like, I'm going to only release my record on 8-track tape. There doesn't seem any reason to do it anymore. And I was so clinging to that format for so many years that it was very traumatic to finally decide, I'm just going to do a book at this point.
Did you start this story? Because it is a very narrative book, although the narrative is broken up in an interesting way. Did you start this story with an idea of the story in mind, or did you start it in the way that you would have started it if it were a Sunday comic, just as a sort of series of narrative sketches based around a character?
Well, the genesis of this actually was that my father was in the hospital, much the way Wilson, the character in the book's father, is in the hospital. And as I was sitting there next to him, as he was sort of, you know, checking out from life, I was reading the biography of Charles Schulz that David Michaelis wrote a few years ago. And I was really sort of connecting Charles Schulz to my father. They were very similar. They both had, like, you know, gray crew cuts and were kind of these Midwestern, soft-spoken, you know, smart men. And so I was really connecting to this book, and there was a part in the book, just a quote from Schulz, where he says, you know, the difference between an amateur and a professional is that a professional can sit down in 15 minutes and come up with a perfectly good gag strip for the next day's paper. And I thought, gosh, I can't do that. You know, I'm not a cartoonist. And I just thought, like, Schulz would think I was such a schmuck that I'm spending like a week writing a comic, you know, comic page. And so I thought, I'm going to do that. As I sit here in the hospital watching my father, you know, fade away, I'm going to sit with my little sketchbook and draw some funny gag strips to sort of, you know, keep my brain occupied. And so that was really where it all began. And the character, who didn't have a name at that point, just kind of emerged out of my pencil without a second's thought. I just created this kind of obnoxious id creature who was voicing my own least popular opinions about people in the airport. You know, I'd just flown in to Chicago, so I'd had all these experiences in the airport. So I was just writing about the most prosaic little events of the day. And the next thing I knew, I had done hundreds of these things. They were just little stick figure doodles with word balloons. And then all of a sudden I realized I knew this character, and this character had come to life, and he now existed, and I had to do something with him. And he kind of took over my life in a way that, you know, that you only hope will happen every so often with a character. And the story developed very naturally from that point on, but it did not really exist in any of those original sketches. It kind of came after I knew who the guy was.
You know, I was reading a bunch of reviews of the book, all of which were completely effusive, I should say. And, you know, there were a lot of Curb Your Enthusiasm comparisons. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, I love Curb Your Enthusiasm as much or more than the next guy.
Me too.
Larry David, as a character on that show, he has... His sort of central principle isn't so much that he creates awkward situations as it is that he has kind of an overdeveloped ethos. Like, he has a position that he believes in with his heart on everything.
Right.
Just a complicated system of beliefs that he is unwilling to leave behind in any situation. And so, you know, when he goes into a situation where he would have to compromise his beliefs, he sort of falls on his face.
Right.
I feel like that's different from the way that Wilson is continually causing complicated situations. It seems like he almost has a sort of goodwill that he's entering situations into that sort of conflicts with the fact that also he's a jerk.
Yeah. I mean, Larry David is playing the character on the show is playing a small game. You know, he really wants to, you know, just play golf or he wants to do things that are sort of easy and simple and just get through life kind of having fun with his own personality and he's not looking to do something. He's not seething with this need to connect. And Wilson is, you know, Wilson's playing him as playing kind of a larger game than everybody else around him. He's trying to make these kind of monumental human connections in a way that he's not even equipped to make the most minor human connection. And it's, you know, there's this huge gulf between those two. And also Larry David has kind of a superpower on his show. He's a multi-billionaire and is able to use that to sort of get around any situation, which I find that very funny that he's sort of upfront with that, because that could be a very off-putting quality on a television show. Whereas Wilson has nothing. He has no hold over anybody in any way. He's really kind of, you know, living by his wits such as they are to just, you know, eke out the most futile existence imaginable.
It's funny that you say that you point out that kind of scale of the game that they're playing, because you're right. I mean, if I were to think of a definitive Larry David moment on Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's when he decides everything is coming up Larry, and he goes into the Starbucks and orders what I guess, well, I'm quoting, so we'll have to bleep this, but he orders a vanilla bullshit.
Right.
And that is his greatest triumph,
right. He
orders that and it is served to him.
Right.
It's so great that he decides to order one for everyone in the entire place because everything is coming up him. Whereas, Wilson's, the great triumph that Wilson hopes for is, you know, basically finding some kind of peace.
Yeah. And he really wants to have a family that, you know, the kind of family that he obviously set up his life earlier to not have. You know, he obviously made all these terrible decisions throughout his life, and now at, you know, 45 or 50 or however old he is, he realizes that, and he's trying to sort of force the issue as in this desperate, implausible way. And he's, you know, he's really looking for some big things. And you know, I mean, to me, the beauty of the Curb Your Enthusiasm is that it's about this guy who could do anything. And you know, I love that he was not interested at all in doing, you know, like the Seinfeld reunion. And, you know, that was just, there was no, you know, he's much more interested in some little thing like the Starbucks thing. You know, I think that's what's great about that. But Wilson's kind of the opposite.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is one of the world's most acclaimed comics artists, Dan Klaus. He's written graphic novels like Ghost World and Art School Confidential. His latest is called Wilson. You mentioned that when you started drawing this, you were sitting next to your dad in the hospital as he was mortally ill.
Yeah.
There's a scene that's very reflective of that in this book where Wilson is sitting next to his dad as he dies in the hospital. Was there something that you wanted out of that in the way that there's something that Wilson wants out of that? So was there some interaction or
it, you know, it, the moments in the hospital were, it wasn't so much about those, but it was about my lifelong kind of preconception of how that would be. You know, I always imagined one day my dad will be on his last legs and I'll be there in the hospital. And I always imagined my dad was a very, I wouldn't say unemotional guy, but he was not someone who expressed his emotions very carefully, although I knew very, very clearly that he was, you know, he was very fond of me and he was a very good dad, but he was not the kind of dad who, you know, gave advice or, you know, said, I really want you to know this about, you know, about me or about how I feel about you or anything like that. And I always thought, I wonder if, like, when all defenses are down and when it's, you know, at that last moment, if he will do that. And then I immediately realized as I was in the hospital that that is utterly against his nature and that was not going to happen. And so I was sort of at peace with that idea, but I had had a lifetime of imagining, you know, what he might say under, if all his defenses were down and he was, you know, on some kind of drug that would make him speak freely about his emotions. I had always been curious. And that, so it was, you know, I was sort of playing off of that idea with Wilson, you know, of if I had actually been really desperate to hear what that was that he had to say.
One of the interesting things to me about the structure is that it's so much about what happens in between, which I guess, you know, is a sort of a central element of comics as a form, right? That something happens between the static pictures that you're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, it happens between the panels. That's where the action is actually taking place. You know, you're not seeing anybody actually move. They're, you know, they're in one place and then they're in another. But I love the idea of taking that, of exploring that area in between the strips. You know, I noticed when I was reading all these Peanut strips in sequence, it had sort of a narrative to it. You know, it would be it's Christmas, and then they go through Christmas, and then he's runs out of jokes for that, and then it's Valentine's Day, and then it's spring, and they play baseball. And it almost seems like this, almost a more truthful narrative than an actual imposed narrative. It's the narrative of life, and it goes on and on. And so I felt like there was something to that. And I also felt like it was a great way to kind of eliminate all the boring parts of a story. You know, it's, I found I could just cut out all exposition if that was needed, and just, you have to imagine how he got from one strip to the next. And some of them are, you know, 5 years apart.
I feel like, though, that you don't exclusively, I mean, it's not a matter of just showing the high parts. Like, I don't feel...
No, not at all. Not at all. It's a matter of showing the best moment, the moments that have the best resonance, you know, the most charged moments. But many of them are two or three in a row in sequence in the same, you know, 20 minutes. And then the next one will be 4 years later. And it's, that to me, that sort of is, I feel like that's replicates the way we remember our lives a little bit. You know, we think of three things that happened one day in 1984, and then we don't remember anything till 1987. And, you know, it had that feeling of the replicating the way memory works. And I found, to me, the interesting thing with the story was I drew all these strips in the beginning, and I had hundreds and hundreds of pages of ideas for this guy, and they all kind of would have fit in the book, but I found that I needed to cut it down to the absolute minimum, and the more I cut, the better the book became, until it got down to almost the absolute minimum. There were two or three at the end I thought about cutting, and I took them out, and they needed to go back again, and I realized that was sort of the perfect length.
The story takes place over quite a long period of time. And, you know, right from the start, it's kind of fueled by that realization that there needs to be some kind of adjustment when you're 42 and right. you've, you know, built a walled garden around yourself. I wonder how coming to that part of your life has affected what you want to create, what's important enough to you to create. And also, especially, I should say, in light of the fact that when you create comics, you know, and you involve yourself in something like this, it takes years. So you're really committing a huge amount of your time towards what you decide to create about.
Yeah. You can't... everybody thinks comics can just be, you know, drawn over a weekend, really. You know, they think you just scribble it out and that, you know, it's an immediate form, and it's sort of the opposite. I mean, film is actually even much more immediate. You know, you shoot a film in a month, and it's inconceivable to do that with a comic. But, yeah, I mean, a few years before I began this, I had open heart surgery, and I was really, it was not looking good, and I really thought, this might be it. And I was sort of, and I was very aware that if I had been alive even 20 years earlier, I was dead. I would be dead by 47 or 48. And I felt like that was sort of, you know, the intent for me at birth. What, you know, that was, the clock was ticking and I had 48 years and that it was about up. And facing that made me kind of think about what was really important to me. And I had to think about, you know, what do I really believe and what are beliefs that are amusing to express, to sound interesting to other people, and what do you really think about things and what do you really believe? And I think I got a lot out of that experience, and I think I really, you know, understood who I was much better after that. And so I think that was sort of my big, you know, midlife moment.
The whole nine yards.
Exactly.
I wonder because, you know, I think probably one of the reasons that so many comic books are about social alienation is that the form is both appealing to the socially alienated and socially alienating in and of itself, because it essentially involves you kind of locking yourself up somewhere and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas making film, and even when you're doing one of the, you know, the kind of more auteurish parts of making a film, which is writing, it's still like this incredibly collaborative thing, you know, like you're often interpreting something, you're working for somebody, you're working for potentially for a director and probably almost certainly for a producer when you're writing. And, you know, there's all this different stuff going on, in this sort of relatively new place in your life. Is it important for you to do one or the other? Is it important for you to do this thing where you have perfect control over the whole world? Or is it important for you to do this thing where you're working with all these different people?
Well, you know, I do love the act of working on comics. I mean, I love doing it. I love every part of it. I like buying the paper at the art store and cutting out the paper and all the little tasks. You know, it has this sort of old world feel of making something with your hands, you know, and it's I don't use computer except for the very final stages, and it's all just cutting out paper and drawing with a pen and a brush and a pencil. And it's very, very satisfying. And to, you know, to go to bed at night finishing up something and to wake up in the morning and sort of seeing it with fresh eyes, that's an endlessly wonderful feeling. And I do love doing that, but you know, you're working in a room there. You know, I'm listening to you guys all day. I'm listening to talk radio all day. And that's sort of my connection to the outside world. And you start to feel like you're in solitary confinement, you know. And I have a wife and a son and lots of friends. And you know, I get out as much as I can. But when you're really working, you are spending 8 to 10 hours a day in this monastic existence in this room. And you see... Most cartoonists that you meet in their 50s and 60s tend to seem like they're kind of losing their mind. You know, they're you can just imagine them talking to themselves or probably swearing to themselves at, you know, that their awful lot in life. And they tend to be very bitter and paranoid. And I felt at a certain stage when I was in my early 40s, like I've got to do something else with part of my time because I do not want to wind up like that. And so I always was interested in movies. So working in movies is kind of the perfect thing because, as you say, you're dealing, even you're writing a screenplay, you know, you're sending people pages and talking on the phone, and it's, you have to shift into this utterly different mode than you have when you're doing comics.
I have to admit that as a guy, you know, I would guess that there are relatively few talk radio hosts who are in a similar situation.
Right.
But I have to say I count myself as one of them. And one of the really lovely things about Wilson in your book is he has this relationship with his dog. And I was like, gosh, you know, like I got a dog and, you know, I have this relationship with my dog where I want to like talk to my dog and, you know, just personify my dog in every way, basically, because outside of my intern who comes in 2 days a week, like that's all I got, you know?
Yeah, that's my, my dog is my companion all day. I mean, I see my dog more than anybody. And I do talk to my dog quite a bit. My dog seems very, has a quality about her that seems like she, on some level, knows all the answers. You know, it's like she's got it figured out. She's got a very happy life. And I find myself saying, you know, dear God, Ella, help me. You know, what am I going to do? And I feel like she, you know, one day she'll say something.
It's sort of like, I mean, in a funny way, that kind of way that a dog seems to have everything figured out is not that far from that sort of being able to sit on the berm or whatever that's called and look at the ocean and just be like, wow, there's the ocean. I like the infiniteness of it rather than like me personally, every time I look at the ocean, I curse its power over me.
Right. I feel insignificant.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's what Wilson gets out of his dog is that, you know, I think he admires that. And there's a strip in the book where he does a eulogy for his dog after she dies. And it reads as though I'm being somewhat sarcastic, but I think it was absolutely sincere in every way. And I felt that very strongly, even though my dog is still with me. I worry about her so much that those kind of thoughts go through my mind.
Well, Dan Klaus, thank you so much for taking all this time to be on the Sound of Young America. It was great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Dan Klaus's latest in a series of critically acclaimed works is the graphic novel Wilson. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our music provided to us by Dan Wally. The show edited by Nick White. Our associate producer is Julia Smith. And our intern is Christian Natividad. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, where you can download any of our past programs, absolutely 100% for free, or share something that you've heard today with a friend. We'll see you next week right here on The Sound of Young America.